Is a June rate cut off the table? Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. With me today is Jim Bianco, president of Bianco Research. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Maggie.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you.
So we have, it seems like a lot of worry in the market. U.S. stocks closing out the week in the red. The yield on the U.S. 10-year now parked at 4.3%. And there just seems to be renewed concern about the economic data that's been coming in, which has been stronger than expected. And we also have this, I think it's against the backdrop of this huge overhang of debt. And these are concerns, especially on the debt front, that have come up all week in the special series we've been running. Before we jump into our conversation, I just want to share some highlights from some of those conversations. Let's have a look.
You know, I always go back to The Simpsons. It's the most prescient show of all time. The real mindfuck of The Simpsons is that was a show started, I think it was 1988. Homer Simpson is an uneducated blue-collar worker, and he owns a home with four bedrooms, two cars, his wife stays at home, and he can afford three kids. That was commonplace in 1988. Nobody looked at that like, what the heck is going on? And then you look at today, can you have that kind of lifestyle on a blue-collar salary? No.
I'm a geriatric millennial. I'm sort of in that elder millennial generation. We're not angry because the price of avocado toast has increased by two or three times. We're angry because we see all the debt that's being racked up. Expecting that when we get to the age that the boomers and others are right now, that there's going to be nothing left for us because we've already borrowed everything.
Debt is a bet. It's borrowing from the future to pay for the present. And it's a bet that the future is going to be richer than the present. And when that doesn't happen, it creates a world of hurt. You have to believe, as you do, you know, we'll innovate our way out of this.
And so that's what happens during populism: contested elections, serious confrontation, global deglobalization, more spending to try and get votes, competitive on both sides. And that means markets go up. But in the context of those periods, just to be clear, those are eras that are very bad for markets. It's just very positive in the context of a very negative thing. We're spending, we're getting ourselves into a bigger hole. We have bigger problems. It's okay for the market. Here comes a blow off top. But be prepared on the other side of it.
The markets go through phases like this, where they are rewarding recklessness and they're punishing discipline. There's also a real issue structurally in terms of how the market's been operating by very few cap tech stocks leading the advance by sheer force of their market cap expansions, i.e. NVIDIA, you know, adding $1 trillion in market cap in a couple of months. Unheard of.
Really, the defining moment here is, as much as we want to talk about AI and the kiosks and things like that and productivity, the real defining moment of this market and the macro backdrop right now is the fact that we've added so much debt and we're running pro-cyclical fiscal deficits at 7% of GDP while unemployment is below 4%. We've never really done that. It's an all-out macro fiscal experiment.
You look now, you know, profits have normalized, the labor shortages have gone. Net, you know, that has to make the chance of a recession more likely. So I don't think we're completely out of the woods. You know, I still worry that there is this sort of recession risk. And I think there's still some problem areas. So, you know, you have commercial real estate, which is basically frozen in time. You have various property markets around the world that are just being kept together on this assumption that interest rates can't stay this high for very long. You know, unless we get a sort of early monetary pivot, there is still a risk that one of these housing markets is going to break.
Look, if you're an investor in urban office or urban retail, I think you need to be prepared for the second shoe to drop because of you know, a lot of space choices that haven't been made yet, a lot of debt that hasn't been refinancing yet. So if you have existing exposure, I think, you know, be prepared if it's equity exposure to write that down, if it's debt exposure to be to provision for potential losses.
Some really unbelievable conversations. And what I love, there was certainly a lot of worry and a lot of gloom, you could say, in them. But almost everyone also had optimistic things that they were leaning into or even contrarian ideas where they saw opportunity. And we're going to dig into that next week. I'll tell you more about all of that coming up. But Jim, there's a lot in there. I want to break down some of those topics. And let's start with the Fed. I think it's fair to say the economy is acting exactly as you had predicted it would, which is that it's been stronger than anyone expected and that things seem to be different. And some of those old models that were predicting recession just have not worked. Where do you see things? And can the Fed actually cut rates with the numbers that we've been seeing?
You know, to start with the second half first, no, I think they're going to have a hard time cutting rates right now. The Fed is still a political animal more than anything else. And if they start cutting rates with a 3 handle on year-over-year CPI, they're going to be risking their political credibility. So they need the inflation rate. As Powell would say, he needs more confidence. We're on our way to 2. Wall Street calls that the last mile, that we're on our way from 3% to 2% on inflation. And the reality is that the data really isn't there right now. It's too strong. Now, why is it too strong? I've often said that every financial crisis and every recession, when we come out of it, things change. The way we change this time is we have seen an increased propensity to spend. The public is willing to spend more money. Savings rates are down from 6% average during the last recovery, 2010 to 2020, to 4%. Consumption has gone from 68% to 70%. We buy more things. That is keeping the economy stronger. That is keeping inflation stickier. And the funny thing you mentioned about the models, most of the models that are predicting recession or soft landing or everything else did not incorporate the idea that the public would be spending more. And you know where those models are actually very accurate? The rest of the world, because they haven't seen an increase in spending. So you've got a technical recession in Japan. You've got a technical recession in the UK. You've had contraction in Canada. One negative GDP quarter in the last 2 has been negative in Canada and in Germany and in the entire Eurozone. So you're actually seeing what everybody's talking about in terms of potential recession and a potential soft landing everywhere but the US. And the difference is we're spending more money. Last off, why are we spending more money? I'll call it PTSD. During the last recession, we were worried the world was going to come to an end, the COVID shutdowns. Then the government mailed us thousands of dollars. So now I think the attitude has changed. I'm going to spend money. Well, what are you going to do about your savings? What are you going to do about the next downturn? I'll take a slow walk to the mailbox and I expect another big check in the mailbox. And that's why they're not worried about saving as much. They're more willing to spend. That is the public, which is going to completely support the U.S. economy. And you add into that a 6% budget deficit, which is going to single-handedly keep the economy out of recession. Mm-hmm. And yeah, GDP is going to stay strong. But the consequence of that is going to be more inflation at the same time. And I think that the data between CPI and PPI showed exactly that this week.
That's so interesting, Jim. And I think that that touched on a lot of what came up, even outside the geopolitical conversation we had. We knew we were going to focus on it there. But even in all of the other conversations that we've been having in this series, which this week is exactly how screwed we all are, and is probably contributing sentiment-wise to the fact that people are going to spend because what the hell? You know, they can't. The future seems like it's so dark anyway. That this populist feeling, they're spending and they'll elect people into office who continue to do that. There is this feeling that they want politically to keep that fiscal dominance going. And so there's this interconnectedness between the sort of political atmosphere we're in, the fact that we're facing elections, and you're going to continue to get the government stepping on the gas.
There's no, it's not a coincidence that people are spending, they're willing to spend. Like I said before, you know, you're running a $1.8 to $2 trillion budget deficit, which is like 6% of GDP. The only other times we've run a 6% GDP budget has been in a recession as a response to a recession. Now we're just, that's our new baseline is what it is. So we're like permanently in panic recessionary spending mode. And so, like I said, the good news from a political standpoint or anything else, GDP numbers are going to look okay. They're going to be 2.5-3% real growth above the potential of the U.S. economy, which is somewhere between 2-2.5. That's what it's been for the last 6 quarters. Bad news is, I think inflation rate is going to stay up. And it's showing up in the marketplace. I know you got a chart, if we put the chart up, of the probabilities that the Fed is going to cut rates. It's 1%. That brown line on this chart is, what is the Fed probability they're going to cut rates next week at the March 20th meeting? It's 1%. What is the probability they're going to cut rates at the May 1st meeting, the meeting after that? It's around 10%. In other words, 90% chance that they're going to hold at that meeting. So March and May, they're going to hold. What about June? June is slumped all the way to about 54, 53%. It's effectively, that's the blue line on the chart. It's effectively a coin toss. And if you look at the trend, check back in about 2 weeks and it should be under 50%. And the red line is July. Now, the July meeting is kind of interesting because I've argued that when it comes to the Fed, it's May, June, or bust when it comes to a cut. That it's either going to happen in May or June, or it's not going to happen until 2025, only if the data warrants it. Why? The July 31st meeting, or the July 31st meeting, is between the Republican and the Democrat conventions. The Fed wants to be Homer Simpson, fade into the hedges, don't talk about me, don't notice me during an election. They change policy between the conventions. They become the story. They become a story for the election. They become a voting issue for the election. That's exactly what they don't want to do. So if they're going to start cutting rates, it's got to be May and June, or they're going to hold till after the election. And then we're talking about November, December, only if the data weakens enough to give them reason to do it. Because right now it isn't. And that's why all the rate cuts are disappearing. And last thought for you on that. Why isn't that bothered the stock market until about 2 days ago? Because the stock market is all, I think the way that I've heard people explain it is, why are you bothering looking at the data? Why are you bothering? Jay told us he's going to cut rates. That's good enough. He promised me he's going to cut rates. I don't care what the payroll report said. I don't care what the CPI report said. I got a promise from Jay he's going to cut rates. But only maybe in the last 48 hours are they starting to realize, you know, sometimes Jay says he's going to do things and then he doesn't follow through on them. And that has happened in the past, and it maybe it might be happening again right now when it comes to these rate cuts in 2024.
Yeah. I want to bring up a couple bigger picture themes, but AJ asking, what do you make of trueflation numbers and lagging indicators like shelter? Maybe the Fed has already hit their target and that's why the rhetoric is so dovish?
Yeah. So trueflation, you know, you can go to trueflation.com and you can look at it. Here's my issue with trueflation. Their measures of inflation are accurate. Their weightings of inflation is where the issue comes in. The CPI report says 40% of the weighting is shelter. Trueflation, I think, is like 26%. That right there accounts for most of the difference between them. So it isn't the prices that they're coming up with. It's how they weight these things. They overweight consumer items that you buy at the grocery store relative to CPI. They underweight housing. So I feel like what I'd like to see from trueflation is not a white paper on how they calculate their measures. They have that. I'd like to see a white paper on how they come up with their weightings, because that's really, how much do we spend on housing? That's really the question that we want to know, because then we know how much to apply housing numbers. To the other half, that the lagging indicator of OER, yeah, it is a lagging indicator, but it's such a lagging indicator. And I've talked about this. I've even tweeted about this. It's such a lagging indicator. It hasn't even caught up yet to the big burst of housing inflation that we had in 21 and 22. I think it's going to stay sticky because it still has to catch up to that before you can even talk about it slowing down. So it's going to be problematic, I think, as well, too. That's why you saw 6/10 in January on OER, a 6/10 increase in the month of January, much more than everybody expected, a 4/10 increase in February. These are numbers that are going to keep the inflation rate above 3%. And if they're above 3%, there is going to be no rate cuts.
Yeah, owner equivalent rent is what Jim's talking about.
Yeah.
Jim, what about people who say, let's get back to that sort of big issue of this humongous debt that we have that shows no sign of slowing down, as we just talked about. There are some people who say, listen, the Fed's not going to admit it, but they're going to ease because they have to get the interest rate payments down. Inflation, no inflation. We're just going to be in a higher inflationary environment. That's just that they're just going to have to bite the bullet and do it. They don't want to say that, but that's ultimately what's going to force their hand.
That would be the single worst idea that the Fed could possibly do. If they did that, if they said too much debt, so I have to make it easier for you to take out more debt, they're going to make it orders of magnitude worse. And if they say too much debt, so I'm going to make it easier for the government to borrow even more money, are we thinking that the Fed's going to cut rates and the government's going to say, you know what, Jay, I promise I won't borrow another dollar more. We'll just pay off what we've got right now if you would just lower rates. No, if you lower rates, they're going to increase the amount of spending. They're going to increase the amount of inflation that we have. So you cannot look at it that way. Go to your bank and tell your bank you lost your job and you can't pay your mortgage. Would you cut my interest rate? It doesn't work that way. Yeah. You're a bigger risk if you tell them that. You should have a higher interest rate. You become a subprime borrower. You become a higher interest rate at that point. So no, the Fed can't do that. If they do that solely for that reason, they risk more inflation and they wind up making the situation worse. As a corollary to that, I've often argued, two people say, well, the Fed's going to cut rates because they want Biden to be president. And I don't believe that. I don't think the Fed's partisan, but let's just go with that. They want Biden to be president. They're going to cut rates because Trump said he'd fired Powell and Powell wants to keep the job. It doesn't work that way either, only in that you can't just randomly say on some Tuesday, I need to cut rates to get this guy elected. If you cut rates in the face of higher inflation, you risk blowing up the bond market. And you've made it orders of magnitude worse.
Right. I mean, it's an oversimplification when people say that. I just think that that always sounds bonkers to me. By the way, every incoming president always says they're going to fire the Fed chair. I mean, there is no job security unless the market starts. The market is the one who votes usually on the Fed in terms of confidence. Honestly, like whenever they threaten to fire the Fed chief, the markets get uncomfortable and they back off. And if they don't get uncomfortable, then they move forward. I mean, that just sounds like conspiracy to me, but right. I hear what you're saying about the bad spot that they're in. So let's talk a little bit about where markets are, and then we'll get to some more of these questions. So there's still a chance the Fed is going to ease. The probabilities are coming down, but they're still thinking they'll get something in June, at least a 50% shot. I think that's what you said, right? Is this net positive for the markets because the Fed's going to be providing liquidity, or has all of that been priced in the stock market already?
No, I think the market has priced in several rate cuts this year, the stock market. The bond market's a little bit different, but I think it has priced in several rate cuts and it expects them. And if it doesn't get them, it's going to be disappointed. And I would argue to you, let me go off on this other tangent here. I'd argue to you, the market is desperate for rate cuts. It needs them. It's going to define the rest of the year. Why do I say that? This is, first of all, let me start off. This is the most concentrated rally maybe we've ever seen. It's on par with the Nifty 50 stocks in the 70s, or the television stocks in the 50s, or the tech bubble in 1999 and 2000. Four stocks have accounted for over half the gain in the S&P this year: Nvidia, Microsoft, Meta, and Alphabet, Google. Amazon is the fourth one that we can't afford it. And Nvidia is a third of this S&P's gain. Mm. Nvidia is half of QQQ's gain this year. That is extraordinary. That company was, until 2 days ago, up over $1 trillion in market cap. Why is it that the rally is so concentrated? When I looked at previous concentrated rallies, I'll give you a simple stark number. There isn't enough money to push all the stocks up in the world. It's $53 trillion of stocks in the United States on a $29 trillion economy. We need more money. We need the Fed to stop QT. We need them to start maybe, you know, expanding their balance sheet again. We need them to cut rates. There's $1.5 trillion that has gone into money market funds in the last year and a half that is sitting there getting a 5% yield. They're happy with that 5% yield, because the long-term expectation of the stock market is 8%. So I'm getting two-thirds of the stock market's gain with no market risk. What the market needs is the Fed to cut rates so all the wealth managers could scream at that $1.5 trillion, Tina, there is no alternative. You got to get in the stocks. So then we could take up the Russell 2000 stocks, the mid-cap stocks, and the other 493 stocks in the S&P will have some money to bring them up. Mm-hmm. This is why I think that the rally is so concentrated. It is sucking up all the money into just a handful of stocks, and why we need the Fed to feed it. Now, of course, the problem is if the Fed feeds it, they risk inflation. Mm-hmm. And if they get inflation, they make it worse. That's the dilemma. The market has decided, the stock market has decided Jay's going to cut and there is no inflation.
But well, he told us he was. I mean, that right. Previously he said that.
He also told us inflation was transitory a couple of years ago.
That's true. And they always reserve the right to change their mind. So maybe we should be taking that into consideration.
Right. And I think as we go forward, they're going to start to realize maybe inflation isn't is stickier than everybody thinks. And the Fed isn't going to cut. And all that money you're hoping for that's going to help push into risk assets is going to sit there in bond funds. And it's going to sit there in money market funds, and it's not going to move. Now, this is not 1999 when the yields were zero, and we screamed Tina to the high heavens and shoved everybody into risk assets. This is a much different environment. That's why I said, I think the stock market sees the bond market as competition, and it needs rates mm-hmm. down so that you can then get that money into it, and it might not. It's not ready to concede. It's not ready to run up the white flag and say, there isn't going to be any rate cuts. The bond market, by the way, is. I think the bond market's there.
Yeah, let me ask you, Tommy Thornton saying, hi, Jim and Maggie. Hi, Tommy. Two-year yield closed above Feb closing high. Across the curve, rates are close to those highs. What do you see happening with rates here?
I think rates are going up. I think that if the Fed is not going to cut rates, the two-year yield is suggesting that too, that you're going to see short rates stay up. You're going to then get a reality that long rates are going to start to see sticky inflation. And that if we are in a three-ish inflationary world, which I think we are not a three-ish inflationary world, and I might just throw out to everybody, remember 2020, everything changed. Everybody tells me that we have a deflation bust coming. That was the cycle that ended in 2020. This is a new cycle that we're in right now. And the deflation bust is the old cycle. The new cycle as we move forward is inflation. If that reality becomes more known, then people are going to look at a 4.30 10-year note and say, in a 5.5% funds rate world that isn't coming down, and in a 3-ish inflation world, that 10-year note is too low a yield. It's got to go higher in that yield. And I think that those yields are going to continue to move higher, and they're going to pressure the market. Remember last year by October, the 10-year went to 5%. And two things happened. Bond funds saw a giant suck of money come into them because people said, 5% yield, let me in. I'm there. And the stock market corrected 10%. And that was the last correction the stock market had, was by the end of October, because we were at a 5 handle on yields. Now, so what I'm trying to argue is this whole idea that rates don't matter. Yeah, they always matter. They may not matter this week. They might not matter next week. But at some point, if they keep heading higher, they are going to matter.
When we're talking about alternatives, what about the competition coming from gold and Bitcoin? We've seen those flows into the Bitcoin ETF. I think Jared was on pointing out that they're almost up to where the gold ETF is. What about that dynamic?
Well, there's two interesting things going on there, because if you look at the gold ETFs, there's like $90 billion in the gold ETFs, like 55 in GLD alone. IAU's got another 25. They have been getting consistent outflows since 2020. Money has been coming out of those things for 4 years. Yet the gold price continues to go higher. So what does that tell you? It tells you that it's not a bunch of American degenerate gamblers that are buying gold. It's probably people in India. It's probably people in China. And they're probably buying physical gold to push it higher. So that's the first thing it would tell me. Second of all, what's happened with the Bitcoin ETF, and you're going to get me in a witness protection program, the Maxis are already mad enough at me as it is that I think that a lot of that money is short-term speculative, small retail type of weak-handed money. Mm-hmm. It is plowing in because they expect to make quick profits, and they have. And people say, no. It's the Greenwich Country Club telling their wealth managers that they want 5% of their wealth in Bitcoin permanently. I don't think it's any of that. It can be over time, but I don't think it's any of that. Now, when will I be wrong, or when will I admit I'm wrong? Let's see Bitcoin sell off 20 to 25%. The last time it did that was last month, by the way, when it had a 25% correction. And let me see that those big inflows don't turn into gigantic outflows. And I think that the Bitcoin community's gotten themselves way ahead of themselves. You know, I had an old mentor that used to say that when they drag out the rulers, that that is the end of the move. And what I mean by that is there was a brokerage firm that put out a report that said $220 billion is going to come in the Bitcoin ETFs. And they said it's going to be $5 billion a month every month until the end of time. Ah, we're dragging out the ruler. Here we go. Bitcoin inflows until the end of time are going to just keep going and going and going. Everything else in the world is cyclical, but not Bitcoin ETFs. That's not cyclical. Let's see what happens on the next downturn. I think a lot of this money's weak-handed. I think it runs for the exits. I think it turns into a gigantic volatility event. And then I think those wealth managers and the Greenwich Country Club participants, they get a little bit nervous about putting money into it. And that could actually work out. That could work against them.
Interesting.
Remember the last thing I'll point out to everybody that like wants to push back on this. If you go to a wealth manager, there's a reason. You're already rich. So that whole have fun staying poor thing, they're already rich. And what is the job of a wealth manager? Not to make you poor. I don't give you $15 million and say, please turn it into 100. I give you $15 million, Mr. Wealth Manager, and say, don't turn it into 5. And putting money into a Bitcoin ETF, maybe to some, sounds like you're trying to turn it into 5. You know, and so that's why I think that this whole idea that there's this mass adoption coming from wealth managers, it can over time. But it isn't this fast.
But we're not there yet. Yeah. Super interesting thought, Jim, because if that's the case, then, I mean, this is why Raoul keeps saying, don't fuck this up, because you think it's trading like a risk asset, basically, just like a, you know.
Yeah, if you overlay.
Momentum risk asset.
I'll tweet this out after we're done here. But if you overlay TQQQ, which is the triple leverage QQQ with the price of Bitcoin, it's the same thing. Mm-hmm. And it's been the same thing for like 7 years. So it is trading like a highly levered technology stock is what it is. And I've railed about this for years. I was like, this is not good for Bitcoin. It should be an alternative asset, which means it shouldn't be correlated to it. It shouldn't rally only when all the technology stocks are on fire, and it shouldn't sell off when all the technology stocks are going down. I'd like to see it a little bit more uncorrelated. But the problem is it's got the same people in it. The same people that are buying the double leveraged NVIDIA ETF or buying NVIDIA zero days to expiration options are the same ones that are buying the Bitcoin ETFs. And that's what's got me concerned. Not that what's got me concerned is it's going to be a big volatility event. Not that the price is going to collapse and lose you a lot of money. And then that whole idea that these Bitcoin ETFs are going to lead to another adoption wave, you're going to scare the hell out of those people with volatility. Remember, the job of a wealth manager is not to make me poor, and to watch something gyrate around wildly 20 or 30% sounds like something that's going to make me poor, and it's going to, you know, basically shy those people away from adopting Bitcoin. I'd like to see them do it. I'm just worried that we've just got a little bit overheated speculatively.
That's some great perspective there. Brian and Super Mario, let's grab that, because I'm going to be sitting down with Raoul and Jamie Coots, our chief crypto strategist. And I'd love to put that to them, Jim, because I think it's a really good point. And beware leverage, people, please. Beware leverage. We talk about this all the time, and we're trying to, you know, for those who participated and maybe got hurt in the last cycle, trying to be smarter about it this time. So we'll tackle that. I'll bring that up to them because I love that idea. Going to squeeze a couple questions in here, and I want to get this one from Doug. Jim, if rates remain high, will the dollar stay high and commodities challenged?
Yes, and yes. The dollar, you know, at the end of the day, unless there is some other geopolitical issues out there, the dollar usually trades as a relative differential of interest rates. If our interest rates stay sticky, and I mentioned, you know, negative GDP in Europe, negative GDP in Japan, negative GDP in the UK, and especially in Europe, if the ECB is going to cut rates and we're not going to cut rates and widen that spread, that benefits the dollar. The other thing that benefits the dollar, and we saw this in 2020, is, and I'll use some technical language here, when the shit hits the fan, everybody runs to the dollar. You know, when things get ugly and we've shut down the world economy because we've got, you know, the zombie apocalypse coming, step one, put all your assets in the dollar. Step two, figure out what's going on. So when the world gets unstable, the dollar benefits from that too. Look at Ukraine, look at the Middle East, and that's got a bit of a dollar bid as well. And yes, that will keep commodities on balance challenged. The one exception to that, the two exceptions to that of obviously are gold, which is at an all-time high, which I think is really more of a, like I said, an overseas demand story, and oil. Oil is at a four-month high again. And gasoline prices are at a four-month high again, too. Let's remember that OPEC and the Russians, OPEC Plus, have been cutting back production quite a bit and have been trying to constrict supply and trying to push the price higher. Maybe they're finally starting to succeed in that. But once you start getting away from those two commodities, the rest of them are definitely struggling because of the high dollar.
One more quick one. We're going to have to keep it brief. Ralph saying news reports, we're talking about Europe maybe cutting before we do. News reports suggest Japan will raise rates.
They have to raise rates, but they're raising rates. Remember, they're getting rid of negative interest rates. I think that there's like literally like one negative yielding bond left in the world. There's like one after we had 17 trillion 5 years ago, and it's in Japan, and it's a short-term bond in Japan. And they're trying to just get off of zero. So the raising rates, yes, but really they're raising them to zero or maybe just slightly above zero. So there's no high rates in Japan. And the market has already discounted that for months and months. And so when the day comes that they do it, and it could be at next week's BOJ meeting, I don't think it's going to create the ripple that everybody thinks it will.
Amazing. Jim, somebody said Jim's on fire. You're always on fire. We love catching up with you, Jim.
Well, I hope my bracket's on fire. You know, March Madness starts on Sunday. So let me just officially announce 2 days before the brackets come out, my bracket is busted.
There's always hope, Jim. There's always hope.
No, not with that. I always.
Oh my gosh, it's so crazy, but it's so much fun. I think everybody's gonna be loving it. We'll do some fun stuff around that. Jim, thank you so much. I just